Beautiful Muscle. The podcast is starting.
Hello and welcome to Podtrificus Totalis, a Harry Potter read-along podcast. I am one of your hosts, Joe.
And I'm Cassie.
And today we're going to be reading chapter one of The Chamber of Secrets.
Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets.
Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. How dare I? The worst birthday.
Yeah, it's the first episode of Chamber of Secrets. And as you can see, we've made some deep structural changes to the podcast.
Totally different now.
Yes. I've had a note on my desk for like 3 months now that says changes for chamber, because I like alliteration. And number three on that list was Joe says hello.
So I was not made aware until today.
Yeah. So we're trying to play around and seeing what works. And you'll see some of those changes throughout the episode.
This was a very short chapter. So you're in luck, because we're going to spend a good chunk of this talking about the history of the Chamber of Secrets.
I found other things to pattern the episode with is what Joe's trying to diplomatically say. So Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets was published on July 2nd of 1998 in the UK. I was 3 years old. Joe, I don't think, was born yet.
1998? How old do you think I am?
Young.
I was...
You were a
two.
Year old. Not Wait, even. July 2nd.
July 2nd. I was almost two.
Yeah, you were almost two. And so July 2nd, 1998 in the UK, and June 2nd, 1999 in the US. I do not know why there was such a big gap. Like a year later, it was published in the US versus the UK. But that's what it says. The book is dedicated to Sean P.F. Harris, and it says he is a getaway driver and a foul weather friend. So I did a little research. Harris was Rowling's friend as a teenager when she was in her last year of high school, and he owned a blue Ford Anglia, which we will see appear in this book.
Spoiler alert.
It's on the cover of the UK edition, so not really a spoiler. So Rowling and
also a car appears. Big spoiler.
Rowling and Harris would drive away to bars and clubs or just talk in Harris's car because, as I said, they were in high school and they lived in a small town. So like getting a car is a big deal because you don't have to rely on your parents for rides. And it's kind of a symbol of freedom when you're a teenager, generally speaking, for most people, or at least people that live in places that have cars. I guess not if you live in like a city. So Harris had this car, and he was this old friend of Rowling's, and he has inspired some of Ron's character. She says indirectly, there's only one character in the whole Harry Potter series that she says that she has based specifically and intentionally on one person, but a lot of Harris's traits have just seeped into Ron.
Now, would that specific intentional thing be her and Hermione?
No. I think the distinction is that like there is one person that was like a one-to-one, like, I'm going to take this person and put him into the Harry Potter universe.
Person?
He will be introduced in this book. But other characters, she pulled traits from a lot of things. Like, she wasn't making a one-to-one copy of herself with Hermione. She thought about the character that she wanted Hermione to be and borrowed a lot of things from her childhood and based Hermione off of that.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of similar for Ron, she knew the character that she wanted Ron to be and was inspired by various people in her life, which we will talk about as Ron's character develops, because there's other things that are based off of other people. But Harris specifically, she borrowed a lot of things from Ron, very much because Harris, she's saying in this, is her kind of escape from the small town life and maybe things that she wasn't entirely happy with in her childhood. And Ron is very much Harry's escape in
yes.
the early chapters of this book, without getting into too much detail, because we're still in the first chapter.
And there's no escape yet.
There's never going to be an escape. We got six more books to do. So Rowling...
Oh, I just meant in chapter one.
Oh, yeah. So Rowling has said that Harris was the first person with whom she seriously discussed becoming a writer. And he told her that she would be a success and supported her in that goal. So a cool little dedication.
Friend.
Yes, definitely a good friend. And I believe she has said that she is still friends with him. There's not a lot of information about him. He's in the military, I think.
Do you think he is ride or die?
Yes. So other things about this book. Rowling said in an interview in October of 2000 that she had her first and only experience with writer's block when writing Chamber of Secrets. that will definitely change with definitely Order of the Phoenix, which she had a major period of writing block with. But this was in 2000, which is well before she started Order of the Phoenix. Mm-hmm. She had her first and only experience with writer's block with this book because the first book was so popular and she was worried about Chamber of Secrets like living up to that and, you know, or it being a complete disappointment and the series losing all of its steam.
Mm-hmm.
There are also some interesting ties to Half-Blood Prince with this book. And I want to read some things that she has said in an interview, direct quotes, and I will not spoil anything, but interesting stuff. So let me pull that up.
All right, go for it.
Okay, so Rowling said...
Oh, this is such a website.
It's a great website. It's called Accio Quote, and it archives literally and transcribes literally every interview that Rowling has done. And since a lot of these interviews are from the late 90s, early 2000s, a lot of them were like television specials or radio things, and so it's an incredible resource. I've used them a lot.
Okay, but this is a very early 2000s looking website. This is just text on a page.
Yeah,
there's slight variation in the font.
We can talk about fonts later.
We don't need to
when we're alone. Okay, so Rowling says key things happen in book two. No one knows how important things are yet. There's a lot in there. And I know how difficult it was to get it all in there without drawing too much attention to the clues. All of the important stuff from book two got into the film. So basically, this isn't a direct quote, but basically the plot line from Half-Blood Prince was originally going to be in Chamber of Secrets. And I don't want to say what the plot line of Half-Blood Prince is, but most people would know. So that was originally going to be in Chamber of Secrets. Rowling eventually decided that the two storylines, the Chamber of Secrets storyline and what would become the Half-Blood Prince storyline, were competing for attention and it was just too much. So she ended up cutting the Half-Blood Prince storyline and saving it for later. Mm-hmm. But it was originally going to be in Chamber of Secrets. So she says on her website, there's no trace of the Half-Blood Prince storyline left in Chamber of Secrets. But the link between the two books relates to a discovery Harry made in Chamber of Secrets that foreshadows something he finds out in Half-Blood Prince. One of her other deciding factors, too, was that she felt she was revealing too much too early with that Half-Blood Prince storyline. So, again, she decided to cut it and save it for later.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was interesting. I never knew that. I stumbled upon it because I was reading some pages on the just like background of this book. And people said that Half-Blood Prince was a working title for this book. And I was like, what?
That's very cool.
It is very cool.
Yeah, I had no idea about this.
Yeah. And I think that Chamber of Secrets, and this is kind of going to get into our personal history with the book, which we will get into. I think Chamber of Secrets is a very focused story. Like, there's not a lot of extraneous stuff going on in it, but it builds so much of the foundation of what the series will be about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that it makes sense that there was like going to be some huge revelations in it with the Half-Blood Prince storyline that were eventually taken out and saved for later because it shows that she had that foundation ready to go and she was able to drop hints in about it.
Yeah, so much of this series seems like she knew what was supposed to happen at the very end and was just breadcrumbing this in throughout.
Yeah, and I think that that is very much true from what I've seen and read about her writing process.
It's that or she's really great at working backwards.
And I don't want to paint her as some kind of mastermind that doesn't do that because there is definitely some working backwards in these books.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I do want to read a great list that our friend Galadriel compiles. Galadriel is in the author of The Ultimate and Unofficial Guide to the Mysteries of Harry Potter. She has a great list of questions that are just still lingering after Philosopher's Stone. I don't care for all of them, so I'm only going to read a couple. But I think that this is a good recap for us and for our listeners of like, hey, these are the things we're still trying to parse out. So why did/does Voldemort want to kill Harry? What happened the night Harry's parents died and why was the house destroyed? Voldemort says he killed Harry's father first. Voldemort's a liar. Do we believe him? Why can't Dumbledore tell Harry why Voldemort wanted to kill him? Is Dumbledore in control of events? What is the history behind Lily and Petunia? Why did the Sorting Hat want to put Harry into Slytherin? Why does Snape hate Harry so much? Why was Hagrid expelled? And that's it.
So some of these we're going to get the answer to.
Some of them
in
were
this
not.
Book. Some of them were not. I'd love to make theories about answers to that question, but we both know the answer to a lot of them, unfortunately. So we can't exactly bounce anything off each other right now.
I mean, we can,
but
we can just cut it out. So as I said, I want to talk a little bit about our personal histories with the book because I, in particular, have a big personal connection to this book. This is the first Harry Potter book I actually read. I think I said this on a previous episode, but when the first movie came out in 01, I think it was, I watched the movie. I loved it. I was very young and I was like, hey, well, I know what happens in the first one, so I'm just going to skip to the second one. And it took me a while. I read 2, 3, 4 and then looped back around and read book one. So Chamber of Secrets is the first Harry Potter book I actually read. And so that I think it just gives me a I regard this one higher than maybe other people would because of that. But on the other hand, I love this book. I have always, when I try to rank the Harry Potter books, so that people know that very important for information of how I think the Harry Potter books work in terms of quality. I've always placed this one near the top, if not the top. So I'm really excited to do Chamber of Secrets.
Yeah. So I only read the books for the first time a couple years ago. And before that, the Chamber of Secrets was one of my favorite movies.
The movie is great.
Yeah, it is a very good movie. It wasn't my very favorite movie, but it's way up there.
Yeah. I think that this book and the movie do a great job of balancing the plot development with whimsy. There's a lot of fun stuff in this book.
Yes. Yeah. And they make a great use of just showing the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So with that said, we are going to get into the chapter summary, and we're trying something new for the chapter summary to maybe minimize some arguing and some episode time.
I don't know about arguing, but
we are going to start timing our chapter summaries and trying to do them within 30 seconds. So it's a bit of a challenge that we've given ourselves, but we're going to try to live up to it, and we maybe will extend that time period if necessary.
And just to test our luck, I am going first.
Yeah.
And as usual, well, not as usual, but similar to the last couple episodes, I have not taken notes or written out a...
Sure. All right. Well, then good luck.
This is going to be an unfair judge of the 30 second timer because three things happen, maybe.
Well, then it'll be easy for you.
All right. Let's do this. So we open with Harry Potter at breakfast getting yelled at by the Dursleys. We get a recap of the last book, and then Harry is sent to his room. Well, Harry has to do some chores because he makes fun of Dudley pretending to do magic, and then he is sent to his room while Vernon entertains some guests, but there's somebody in his room or something. We don't know yet.
Okay, he did it in 30 seconds. So obviously 30 seconds is the right amount of time for that, and we will never adjust it.
We'll see.
One important thing that you left out of the chapter summary is it's Harry's birthday.
Well, everyone else forgot, so why should I remember?
Yeah, it's Harry's birthday, and the chapter's called The Worst Birthday, so it's not a very good one.
But also, of all people to remember, Dudley does, and he uses it just to make fun of him.
And it is... I wrote The Return, but it might be the first instance we have of snarky Harry, because Harry provides one of my favorite responses to this. Dudley says, "I know what day it is." And Harry...
Congratulations, you learned the days of the week.
It's such a good burn. It's great. I love snarky Harry. But perhaps because the chapter is a little light, I want to ask, what is your worst birthday experience?
My worst birthday experience.
Yeah.
I don't know. I never really make a big deal out of my birthdays. Like, yeah. Mine is coming up.
Yeah.
It might be the week that this comes out. And
Joe's birthday is the day after Harry Potter's.
Yes. And J.K. Rowling.
Yes.
Every year I usually go to my aunt's house around my birthday. Mm-hmm. Sometimes on my birthday, if that works out. Other than that, nothing really special.
Okay.
So I don't really care about my birthday that much.
I thought you would say the year that you got your wisdom teeth out, like 2 days before your birthday.
Oh, I don't remember that. So I can't say that's my worst birthday.
Okay.
I just have no memory.
Okay, that's fair. I do have a worst birthday experience. I don't know that. I think this was on my actual birthday, but being a child of divorce... you know, we had various visitation arrangements with my dad, but one of them was that on Wednesdays, we would go to Wendy's and have dinner and then go back home. And that was when I saw my dad. And so one of those fell on my birthday or around my birthday. And I think that maybe when I went to the bathroom while we were eating our Wendy's, my sister may have reminded my dad that it was my birthday, because when we got into the car to go home, he pulled out an Entenmann's donut with a candle stuck in it and sang happy birthday to me in his car, and then handed me like a donut he'd been holding that had had a candle in it. And that was probably my worst birthday.
Was it just one donut? Like, did he have the rest of the box somewhere?
I don't know. He only gave me that one donut.
Like your siblings didn't get a donut?
I don't think so. I don't totally remember. I was also like 15. So this wasn't, I guess, that long ago. But I mean, I don't know what's better. He went, because that Wendy's is right by a supermarket. Either he went to the supermarket to get an Entenmann's donut and gave me the one Entenmann's donut, or he just had a loose Entenmann's donut in his car that he used to sing happy birthday to me. Either way, it's bad.
Not great. But I'd also be very impressed if he, while you were in the bathroom, made it to a supermarket, bought donuts, and came back.
Maybe. I don't remember super well. I really just remember the donut in the car. I don't remember how it materialized or if he disappeared at some point in the night. There was also the year that my mom and my sister won tickets to go see U2 in Florida, and they weren't there for my birthday. And so my grandparents had to watch us, and that was a whole ordeal that I don't want to get into. But yeah, so they weren't there for my birthday, and my aunt's birthday is the day before mine. So we would always go to my aunt's house and just celebrate both of ours. But since nobody was there for me, it was, you know, more in favor of my aunt. I was younger at the time. I was like 10 or 11. And also my mom and my sister like came home that night. So everybody was like, how was the concert? And it's like, well, it's my birthday. Yeah. But yeah, so those are, I think the Entenmann's donut is worse, but that's my worst birthday. I don't know if it's as bad as Harry's. I don't think so.
No,
it's not. So back to Harry Potter.
For starters, nobody tried to hit you with a soapy frying pan.
Yeah.
And made you do a lot of chores out in the heat
and then
eat cheese, yeah, and sent you to your room.
Two slices of bread and cheese, which honestly, that's not far off from what I eat on the regular. So
yeah, we do that willingly, unfortunately.
Yeah. They talk a lot in this chapter about Dudley's weight. He eats a lot and his parents are like, we got to fatten him up. He's not getting enough food at Smeltings. His butt is hanging off the sides of the chair. Rowling says that he waddles around the garden. Like it's really apparent, and I was not prepared for it. And when I noticed this pattern, I almost wanted to like have a conversation about fat shaming and whether it applies here. And you can have your opinion about this. I think that Rowling tries to contrast the Dursleys' excess and gluttony with their neglect in Harry.
So she describes everyone again in the beginning of this chapter.
It's very much like, hey, baby didn't read the first book, so let's catch him up for this one.
But she puts so little effort into the descriptions of
the Dursleys. Yeah, and then Vernon is just like fat and mean.
So Uncle Vernon was large and necklace with an enormous black mustache. Aunt Petunia was horse-faced and bony.
Horse-faced, like the animal, or?
Yeah,
okay.
Horse-faced and bony. Okay. Dudley was blonde, pink, and porky. Meanwhile, we get like three sentences of Harry being small, skinny, brilliant green eyes, jet black hair, always untidy. He wore round glasses on his forehead and a thin lightning-shaped scar.
And I mean, he is the main character.
He's the main character. He's the one you should know what he looks like.
Right.
But just the effort put into, okay, so Harry looks good, but the Dursleys look bad and are bad.
I get what you're saying about those descriptions, but there's a lot of other language used around Dudley that I was responding to. So as I was saying, I think that she is setting up a contrast there intentionally. I'm not sure if it is the most progressive way of achieving that goal, but it is at least reinforced in other scenes that don't have anything to do with weight or being fat. Like Dudley's birthday when he gets however many presents and he wants more.
He's like too short from last year.
Yeah. And then like a week later, it's Harry's birthday and he doesn't get diddly squat. So I think that she is just trying to set up that the Dursleys have the means to provide for Harry, but choose not to by making Dudley fat. But it still felt a little weird to me.
Yeah, she goes very hard into them.
Yeah. And they're awful people. I don't mean to like excuse the Dursleys or anything, but like,
but also she
making
wrote
them
that
fat
way.
Is maybe not great. Like, hey, don't you hate this person? Look at how fat they are.
Yeah, it's a terrible mindset.
Good.
It's bad. I mean, mind you, Petunia apparently is skinny as well, but not described as skinny the way that Harry is described as skinny. She's just bony.
Yeah, yeah.
She's too skinny.
And England does not have the same relationship to obesity as America does. So maybe we are responding in a very, first of all, American way, and also in a very 2019 thing, because I don't think there were really as widespread conversations about fat shaming in 1998. But yeah, just something I wanted to bring up.
Yeah, it's a lot.
The Dursleys freak out when Harry tries to teach their garbage son some manners. Dudley like asks him
what's the magic word?
Yeah, Dudley asks him to pass something and Harry says, what's the magic word? And the Dursleys explode as if Harry just said the worst word in the world or some kind of curse word. I didn't want to say curse word because like curses are spells.
just threaten their life or something.
Yeah, something awful like that. Yeah, I just found that scene funny.
Yeah.
Rowling is also back at it with her similes. At one point, Vernon stares at Harry breathing like a winded rhinoceros, which I really liked that one.
That one actually works.
That one works. Yeah, it's not the baby dolphins. In relation to that conversation, though, about the magic word and the Dursleys being afraid of magic, Harry... or the narrator says that the Dursleys don't know that Harry can't use magic outside of school and they've banned any mention of magic. And Harry kind of plays with that idea that they don't know by like threatening to do magic and like keeping them afraid of him so they don't mess with him too much. But this raised a question for me as I was reading it. Wouldn't Petunia know that students can't do magic outside of Hogwarts because she grew up with Lily? I looked up to the answer to that. Rowling said on her website that Lily, as a child, tested the limits of the Statue of Secrecy and received some letters from the Ministry, but it was nothing too serious.
Mm-hmm.
That will become a larger plot point in a later book, the Statue of Secrecy and not doing magic in front of Muggles. Or, well, you know, it's a plot point in this book.
It very much is.
It very much is. But we'll get there. In this big recap that they do of Philosopher's Stone as well, the book refers to Draco as Harry's arch enemy, and then in the literal next paragraph mentions how he faced Lord Voldemort again. So I thought that arch enemy was an odd word to use to describe Draco.
Well, I look at Draco as like, that's more of his equal and an enemy. Like they're probably on similar playing fields, while Lord Voldemort is this like big boss.
But doesn't that make him more of an arch enemy?
I feel like...
like a nemesis.
I just feel like at this moment, Lord Voldemort's so out of Harry's league. Harry escaped him. He talks about, he barely got away from Voldemort. Yeah. He didn't stop Voldemort.
Somebody that is constantly trying to attack you is an arch enemy.
Yeah, but if you're 12...
I guess.
And somebody's mean to you and you're mean back, that's your arch enemy. I don't know.
It was weird. And that's all I really have for the chapter. I think I said in 116 that the series doesn't really do cliffhangers at the end of the chapter, at the end of chapters. I take that back. They totally do. There's a cliffhanger at the end of this chapter. And as I thought about it, I'm like, yeah, there are cliffhangers in these books.
There are always cliffhangers.
Yeah. So maybe I'm just remembering that wrong, or maybe I was an idiot when I said it. But yeah, there are cliffhangers.
Yes, and we've talked about cliffhangers before.
Yeah, we have.
So, yes, there are cliffhangers. This is a big cliffhanger. Earlier in the chapter, before Dudley interrupts him and makes fun of him for it being his birthday, Harry stares at a bush and sees a pair of green eyes. And then Dudley shows up. They disappear.
And then at the end of the chapter, Harry goes up to his room because the Masons arrive for their dinner party or whatever. And there's someone or something in his room.
The trouble was there was already someone sitting on it.
Yeah. Do you have any notes for this chapter that we didn't cover?
Do I have any notes for this chapter?
Okay. So that means it is time for Spell of the Week.
So our Spell of the Week is...
Squiggly Wiggly.
No.
I wish.
It's not a real spell is the problem. I could give you the name, tell you Harry made it up to scare Dudley, and then that would be the end of that.
Okay. What's the real Spell of the Week?
So I chose Lacarnum Inflammari, which cloaks an object in fire. I chose this because while Harry is staring at that bush, Dudley asks him what he's doing, and Harry says that he's thinking of different ways to set the bush on fire.
And we already did Incendium.
Yes, we already did Incendium. And if he's pondering which spell work would be best, he knows a second spell. I mean, he might have been lying or bluffing, but this is another option. It is supposedly what they replaced the blue flame with in the
first
Philosopher's
movie.
Stone movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because she doesn't just place a blue flame on him. Yeah. She just sets him on fire. She just sets Snape on fire.
Yeah.
The etymology, it appears to be derived from the Latin lacerna, which means cloak, and inflammare, meaning to ignite. So to cloak in flame. And fittingly, it could also mean to set fire to a cloak.
Okay.
Which is pretty good. It appears, like I said, in the Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone film, supposedly non-canonically, but that makes sense because it's different from the books, along with the Lego Harry Potter's year 1-4 video game and the Harry Potter Hogwarts Mystery game. That was not the newest Harry Potter mobile game, but the older one.
Yeah.
With really bad microtransactions. I can't promise the newer one.
The newer one does have microtransactions as well.
But the older one was awful with it, and I haven't tried the newer one
yet. I've heard from people that it's also bad. Not that the game itself is bad, but the microtransactions feel a little bad. So that's Spell of the Week. And now we get to move on to emails, because we actually have emails to reply to on this episode.
If you wait long enough, someone will respond.
Part of the reason for this is that I think we talked about this on previous episodes, too. We backlogged a ton of episodes and just put them out. So we received emails as those episodes were releasing, but we had already recorded the episodes after. So we couldn't really reply to them. So we're replying to them now. But the first one is from my sister, Becca. She's on May 7th. Oh, and as a reminder, you can send your emails to owlpost@patrificustotalis.com or go to our website. There's a little email us link that might be easier to use for you. But this one's from my sister, Becca. And she says, so my question is a little complicated, I think. In episode 10, you guys talked about how when McGonagall buys Harry the broom, then the Slytherin team could potentially protest this and ask that Snape buy their seeker a top-of-the-line new broomstick. But shouldn't all the students on the Quidditch team use the same brooms in order to keep a level playing field? Wouldn't this give an unfair advantage to kids from wealthy families? Is this how it works at the professional level, too? Isn't that classist? So, as I understand it, on the professional level of Quidditch, they do use different brooms, but they have a lot more money going on in that. So, they can afford to buy the whole team the broom. So presumably they would be using top of the line brooms just all the time at the professional level.
But also, I'm not sure how the financial situation works, but the better teams might be making more money.
Oh, that's a good
and
point.
Then being and then, able to buy the better brooms and continue to stay better.
Yes, we do know that Ron is a fan of an underdog team, fittingly the Chudley Cannons. And so maybe they don't have the best brooms.
Which is very fitting for the Weasleys.
Yeah, yeah. But no, I think this is a really good point that she brings up that, you know, a team could have an advantage. I do like to think, and I don't think that this is this has any basis in the actual canon of Harry Potter. I do like to think that there are certain brooms that have different advantages than others. Like, generally all we hear about is like, this broom is fast. But like, I think it would be cool if there were brooms that like, accelerated really quickly or
had better handling,
that kind of thing.
Like sturdier or can like hover in place better or something like that.
That way there are different brooms that are maybe more fitted to being like a chaser versus a seeker or what have you. Mm-hmm. So I think that could be interesting. I don't think that has any basis in actual Harry Potter.
But this question is also appropriate for this book. We'll see it coming up soon.
Yeah.
But yes, it would make sense for everyone realistically to have the same broom so that they could be on the same playing field.
Right.
But also, I guess they're not made of money. Some people are.
Yeah. Like Harry.
Like Harry, who didn't even buy his own broom.
Yes. Yeah. So thanks to Becca for bringing Marxist criticism to Podtrificus Totalis.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes. The next email is from my friend Jose. And I believe we've answered an email from him before. I'm going to warn that this one is kind of long. I'm going to read it all and I might provide a longer reply to Jose because he responded to my call to talk about the hero's journey. So me and him will start an email chain about that probably, but I'm still going to read the email. Hello, Cassie and Joe. I've enjoyed listening to you guys breaking down the first Harry Potter novel and all of the personal anecdotes. He actually wrote antidotes, which I thought was funny, but anecdotes. Part of what makes analyzing great stories like this so enjoyable is to hear how others interpret the material as well as how it affected them. When you were discussing how odd money in the UK looked in an earlier episode, it reminded me of when I was in The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, a play based on the Mark Haddon novel. Our director had taken a trip to London around that time and actually got us the exact money that is called for in one of the scenes. I played the main character, and so I had to deal with the money in a scene where I handed the coins to a police officer. When I was first given the money, I remember being amazed at how distinct the coins were and how all of them weren't perfectly round, like coins in the US. While I did try my best at every performance to hand other actors the coins as specified in the script, a £1 coin, a £2 coin, two £10 coins, a £5 coin, and a £2 coin. I can't believe there are that many different types of coins in the UK. Okay. Most nights
those are like instead of dollar bills, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. But there's also pence. What are pence?
We're not getting into that right now.
Most nights it was just me handing, handing him whatever coin I picked up next. So I think nobody in the US understands how these coins work. I also wanted to chime in on some of the hero's journey discussion. This isn't so much of a correction, but as a different interpretation. Cassie did bring up that the descent into the underworld usually happens earlier in a story than it does in the book. And that is something I agree with. I see that the descent actually does take place earlier than the events in Through the Trap Door, the most recent podcast episode as of when he wrote this. I'll also point out that some of the terminology I use is borrowed from The Writer's Journey, a book of Christopher Vogler, to assist with interpreting the monomyth and how to help writers, mainly screenwriters, into telling more compelling stories. In his interpretation, the descent would be referred to as the supreme ordeal, which is actually different from the climax. This is a high point of tension that tests our heroes, and they're ultimately changed by it. To draw a parallel, in A New Hope, the supreme ordeal takes place when our heroes are in the trash compactor. For Philosopher Stone, I would say that the supreme ordeal actually occurs during the Mirror of Erised. In that chapter, Harry is at his lowest point, and his constant use of the mirror could seem as bringing out his inner shadow. And at the end of it all, it changes him. I'm going to take a break from reading just to talk about that. I think that's a really cool idea. I didn't consider the Mirror of Erised as a stage in the hero's journey so much because it's not something that Harry is physically going through as much as emotionally going through.
And it is a big character development.
Yeah.
He does get his advice from his mentor, Dumbledore.
Yeah.
And he does leave that changed person.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really like this interpretation that Jose puts forth. I do want to acknowledge that there could be more than one descent into the underworld. It doesn't have to be a one-to-one interpretation of the hero's journey. But no, I really like the mirror as
yeah,
the
me too.
Descent. As for what stage we were in for Through the Trap Door, they're at what is referred to as crossing the third threshold, or the point of no return. This is the final test for the characters, where they must use everything they've learned in order to survive. It's like how in a video game, when you're in the final section, it has you use all the abilities you've learned in order to finish. To go back to the Star Wars analogy, this is where they are going to blow up the Death Star, and Obi-Wan says, use the Force, Luke. And the chapter does that wonderfully. It plays off Hermione's smarts, Harry's masterful ability of flying, and Ron's ability to handle high-pressure situations. Our characters don't necessarily change here. They're reinforcing and paying off what their whole journey has been about. Again, this is just my interpretation, and I would like to know your thoughts on it. I could definitely go in a lot deeper into how well-structured it is, but I don't want to bore you. Congrats on completing the first book, and I can't wait to hear more. I really like that email. Thank you, Jose. Yes, super detailed. Thank you. And thanks for engaging with me on the hero's journey because Joe didn't want to.
excuse me. I put up with it.
You put up with it. as for the crossing the third threshold, yeah, I agree that that might be a better interpretation. I generally follow the Campbell interpretation of the myth. And I perhaps because I've read the series so many times, I like to conceive of the whole thing as a big hero's journey metaphor, and there being repeated like descents into the underworld and all these other stages. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if we're looking at Philosopher's Stone as a self-contained book, I think that Jose's interpretation is stronger than what I posited on that episode. So good on him for sending that in and correcting me, kind of. Encouraging me to do better. yes. And our last email is from Robin, and it says, I've recently discovered your podcast on Spotify and I've spent the last few days listening to the back episodes. Thank you. I've just finished chapter 12. This is my first email to you, and it's really been about Madame Pince, the librarian. I said that the way I would normally say it. And I'm going to continue for the email because because Robin's correcting our pronunciation. she says, first of all, her name, Madame, she writes. I can't remember how it's written in the book, if it's Madame or Madame.
Hold on, let me just bring it up.
Yeah.
M-A-D-A-M.
Okay, so it is Madame. At least in the edition that we're reading, it could be different in other editions. So in the edition that we were reading, it is written as Madame, but it could be Madame in others.
I'm trying to check it out.
That would fit with the French origins of her name being Madame rather than Madame. So Robin says, first of all, her name, Madame Pins, calls to mind a pince-nez, the funny little glasses with no sides that someone might imagine a very strict old lady librarian might wear. So that I think is interesting. I had to look up a YouTube video of some guy that's an expert on old eyeglasses to figure out how he was saying it. And it sounded like pince-nez to me. It comes from French, and I am really bad at French when I took French. So I could still be mispronouncing this. So maybe we'll get another email from Robin saying like, hey, you said it wrong again, dummies. We mispronounce things all the time. I was saying to Joe earlier that I say Madame Pomfrey a lot rather than Madame Pomfrey. And part of that is just I'm a dummy who's been reading these books for a long time and I've just fallen into bad habits. Another part of it is we have Long Island accents, and I don't think that it's super prominent, but we say things funny sometimes.
I feel like you say some things worse.
Well,
say drawer.
I don't want to talk about that. Now, could you get me something out of the drawer?
but if you do have a correction on our pronunciation, can you spell it phonetically for us?
Yeah, that would be helpful. Thank you for the email and everything, Robin, but we're real stupid. So, like, you got to spell it out for us.
Very literally spell it out phonetically, or maybe even sending a recording of you saying it.
We're asking for a lot here.
Yes,
so that video that I watched of the crazy guy with the eyeglasses, he sounded like he was saying pince-nez. So I guess in that sense, it would be Madame Pins rather than Madame Pince, which is what we were saying. The other, I did find another video. I think it was emmasaying.com, who said it pince-nez. I'm not sure. I truly am not. I think pins is maybe what Robin is pins? Suggesting. Madame Pins.
Pins.
Yeah, like pins, like sewing pins, yeah. Kind of close
rather
to
than
that.
Pince.
Pince, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So hopefully we receive an email correcting on this before we have to talk about Madame Pince, Madame Pins again.
yes, we listened to multiple YouTube videos. All of them pronounced it differently.
Yeah.
And didn't help us at all.
Yeah. So please, some kind of eyeglass expert or something, email in, or Harry Potter expert, one or the other. If there's somebody that's both,
that'd be amazing.
That's the person we need. But Robin does have a second half of her email. So Robin says, second, I don't think of her so much as mean as I think of her as strict. After all, she is responsible for what happens in the library, and some of the books in the Hogwarts library are literally dangerous. Others have a very dark magic in them. As we find out a little later, a student has found very dark magic in library books before. so she takes her job very seriously. Of course, 11-year-olds with something to hide would perceive this as being mean. And I think that if we were goofing on Madame Pins and maybe accusing her of being mean, we were responding to the way that the book is written, which Robin gets at, that we're seeing everything from the perspective of 11-year-olds. So we think that Madame Pins is mean. But no, Robin raises a great point. The Hogwarts library, like all of Hogwarts, is filled with danger. So maybe it's good that Madame Pins is super strict. Those kids also get up to a lot of shenanigans in the library.
So. Yes, and this is only the first book. This is their very first year.
Yeah.
And they've already broken into the more dangerous part of the library. And they're like, oh, she's so mean for looking over us while we go through hundreds of books.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is me and Joe are both teachers, or Joe's the only one with a job, but we're both teachers. And so I think that there's this interesting line that we get at with teachers about teachers being strict versus teachers being mean, that like teachers have to be strict sometimes, a lot of the times, really. And kids often perceive that as being mean. And so maybe it wasn't super tolerant of us to call Madame Pince mean when she's really just being the necessary amount of strict.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm also responding to this. We did a camp this week, and it was really the first time that me or Joe had seen each other teach. We weren't teaching, but kind of teach. And Joe accused me of talking down to the kids and being mean. And I was like, no, I was getting them in order. And that's just how I talk to kids. So really just different interpretations of attitudes.
I didn't say you were being mean. It did sound like you were talking down to them.
I think I was just saying your mouth should be closed and your eyes should be up here.
It's she talked to them the way that you would talk to a dog you're trying to train.
Oh my, that's so mean. That's really mean.
I've trained dogs, and that's how you talk to them.
My perspective of it is that I tell them what they should be doing. Maybe I could have said it nicer.
It's okay. I mean, you got better. That was just like the first time you did it.
I'm also a mean person.
That's not true.
It is true. I've had multiple people tell me that when they first met me, they were very scared of me. And
so that's
found
not
me
mean. You're just intimidating.
Well, whatever. Email in if you think I'm mean.
Please do.
Yeah.
Add some comments.
All right. So that is our episode. It was a very light chapter. There wasn't a ton to talk about, but that is our chapter. We're really excited to get into Chamber of Secrets. As always, you can get in touch with us by emailing us at owlpost@potrificustotalis.com, or you can just visit our website, potrificustotalis.com, and hit the email us button and do it that way, whichever's easiest for you. And you can send us questions, corrections, if we said something wrong or just got something horribly wrong, whatever. Send us questions, corrections, or just your experiences with the Harry Potter series, because we love to hear things about that. Send us what your worst birthday was. I don't know. Send us an email. We need to talk to other people than each other. We're really excited to get into Chamber of Secrets. You can interact with us as well on social media. We have a Facebook page. Just search Potrificus Totalis. It's probably facebook.com/PotrificusTotalis.com. I don't know what kind of monster types full URLs anymore. Our Twitter page is @Potrificus. Those are the only two social media platforms I really pay any attention to. But there are other ones that exist and just aren't updated as much. But those are the best ways to get in touch with us and interact with us. And of course, you can subscribe to us so that you don't miss any episodes. We are found wherever you find podcasts. I'm not going to list any of them anymore because there's too many and they change all the time.
Yes. And if you find any that we are not on, feel free to let us know and we will make any corrections. More specifically, Cassie will make corrections because
Joe shows up.
And you're lucky that happens.
I will absolutely get us on whatever podcast platforms that you need us on that we're not on. And there's a subscribe button on our website that should direct you to most podcast platforms if you can't happen to find us on some. Please, get in touch with us and look forward to more episodes on Chamber of Secrets.
Starting next with Chapter 2, Dobby's Warning.